Hello and welcome to The Stack, a very sunny edition of the show. We speak with Don Davis, the new editor of food title Bon Appetit. Plus, we explore the fascination with crosswords. I mean, what would be a good paper without a crossword? Plus, a new title that is dedicated to good news, something that we truly appreciate here on The Stack. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, I speak with Matt Gaffney, a crossword enthusiast that writes puzzles for New York Magazine, among other publications, plus David McKendrick and his delightful new magazine, Paperboy, dedicated to good news. But we start the show with one of the most famous food titles out there, Bon Appetit. The title is now edited by Don Davis. Their April issue is a thing of beauty, with an eye-catching cover on how 1971 changed food forever. And I loved their retro cover as well. For more on the magazine and brand, and what are their plans for 2021, here is Don.
First of all, Fernando, thank you for having me on. It's so thrilling to be here, and I appreciate you having me. I was a book publisher before. I started out at a small nonprofit working on books about kind of race and culture. And then I moved to Random House, one of the largest publishers in the world, and ended up, before I came to Bon Appetit, at Simon & Schuster, where I had my own imprint called 37 Inc., where I really published a lot of fiction, memoir, history from people from, you know, people of color and otherwise marginalized experiences, kind of bringing them to the center. So yeah, been working with storytellers, but mostly with books.
And did food ever kind of reach the topics of some of your books? How was your relationship with the world of food writing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I, early on at the New Press, actually published a book called Recipe of Memory. And though it was my first food cookbook, it was nominated for, you know, a James Beard Award and an IACP Award. And so I felt really lucky, but also that I was responding to something that the book and the author wanted to say, and I knew what to do with that material to publish it in a, you know, kind of effective and beautiful way. My next encounter was with Anthony Bourdain. I was writing a book myself. I had all of these friends in New York City who came really from all over the world. And, you know, they were getting a PhD at NYU or they were lawyers. And we all had this fantasy that we would open a restaurant. And it wouldn't be fun if we opened a restaurant in the Village, right? It's like everyone's dream. And I said, wait, guys, I think we need a little bit of research. We need to know what's involved. So why don't we interview some chefs? And the stories were really so riveting and so interesting that I turned them into a book called If You Can Stand the Heat. In the process of researching that book, one friend said, look, if you're going to talk to chefs, there's this one guy you have to meet. His name is Tony Bourdain. It was before he'd written his own huge bestseller, though Tony had been a writer of mysteries before that. And so, I had that experience. And then right before I signed up with Bon Appetit, I acquired Nicole Taylor's book on Juneteenth. It's a forthcoming cookbook about Juneteenth and how we celebrate it.
Well, it's fantastic to see you at Bon Appetit. And I was reading a little bit. I mean, actually, the magazine was founded in 1956. That's fascinating because I got to say, like in recent years, we had so many new launches of food magazines. I mean, it's been quite a big thing, but Bon Appetit has been there. So how's the pressure to be at the helm of such an iconic title, if I may say?
Yeah, so it's 65 years ago this year that it was launched. And I learned actually on another interview that it was actually a free magazine in grocery stores. I take it one day at a time. I think that food is at the center of so much that we are thinking about right now. I think of it as an opportunity to have people kind of come for the recipes, but while they're there, we can talk about some important things, some culturally relevant things, and have some fun. So, you know, I have big ambitions for it, but at the same time, I take it one day at a time. And I also have an incredible team. You know, I'm not doing this in a vacuum. My team is obsessed with food. They're knowledgeable about food. They're passionate about what they present to the readers. You know, like I had this idea of 1971 and did the preliminary research of, oh, you know, these four or five things happened that seemed really super interesting to me. But the rest of the team carried the water in terms of the layout and digging deeper and finding more information that even surpassed my expectations and, you know, incorporating recipes. So it does take a village, as they say.
Yeah, you mentioned 1971 there. That's the cover story for the April issue, which I have in hands. And to be honest, I have to be really honest, I never had an idea that 1971 was so important. But I think that's what's good about it. Something that I think not many people might know. And I have to say, the cover is eye-catching. It's kind of retro in a very fun way, kind of some yellow, oranges, greens. I loved it.
Yeah, it's funny. We had a more traditional cover initially, and meanwhile, we had this super interesting package, and we kept pushing, and I kept pushing, and then Marcus Samuelson, who's a global advisor for the brand, saw the type for, you know, and the opening treatment for the cover story. And he said, you know, why aren't we leaning into that for the cover? And that just opened up all the synapses. We all just said, yes, yes. And then Michelle Outland and her team, she's our creative director, just really leaned all the way in. And I think there's the 70s moment with some, you know, Gucci's having a 70s moment. There are a lot of, I think we're all kind of thinking about that, and it worked.
Donna, I would like to ask, of course, we've been through a very difficult year with COVID-19 everywhere. And at least here in the UK, I mean, everybody was talking about how they start cook more, actually, because perhaps they had more time at home. So do you think, in a way, for Bon Appetit to be there for the customers at this difficult time? So I was wondering, how did it change the way the magazine has been done because of COVID? You know, so many things were different.
For sure, Fernando. We saw so much traffic during, you know, March through May, when we didn't know if, you know, you could get COVID by going to the supermarket. And so people were staying in, they were cooking, many for the first time, many were learning to cook. And the great thing about Bon Appetit Epicurious, we also are healthy-ish, and basically is we have verticals and information for people who don't even know how to, you know, boil an egg. And then we have recipes for people who are ready for beef Wellington and beyond and more complex recipes. So we did provide a service, no question. And then we have this fun YouTube channel where there's some real tutorials on the site. Andy Baragani can really walk you through how to cook different things. So we provided a service. And now as we pivot, you know, we're starting to think about, well, people have been cooking for over a year. And how do we keep them interested in the kitchen now that they have all of these skills? How do we keep them interested in the kitchen and that nutritious home cooking that you can provide? So it's been fun to figure that out.
And don't just out of curiosity, I know that the Condé Nast in the food world, there are other brands as you mentioned as well. So it's not only Bon Appetit, you have Epicurious, Hellfish, and basically. So can you go through very briefly about what are those brands and what are they roles together with Bon Appetit?
Sure. So Epicurious is a digital only brand, and they do tons of recipes from the archives that include some Bon App recipes, but as well as Gourmet Magazine, which was part of Condé Nast. They also have great product reviews. So for instance, if you're thinking of getting something to carbonate water, it's a great source to go to for, they really review and test the products. And they have a lot of technique. You know, here's the technique to making dumplings. Bon App is voice driven. It has a lot of personality. We have some great stories, some great reportage on things related to food, such as the 1971 content. Healthy-ish is exactly what it sounds. It's for more people interested in food and lifestyle around a kind of healthy and wellness kind of lifestyle. And then basically is for the beginning cook. And it breaks things down in accessible language, fun language. So, you know, we have a little something for everyone there.
And before I ask your plans for this year, I just want to mention another article from the new issue that I really enjoyed, because for me, food is about emotion. I love Miguel de Leon's piece on rice and how he reminds me where he come from. Because it's funny, I was talking to my partner the other day, because I absolutely adore rice. In Brazil, such a staple as well. So I love it that even if you don't need necessarily to cook, but you can read those beautiful personal stories. And I think that's something you do well.
It's funny that you should say that. I got a really nice email from someone last Sunday. It was rainy, the Sunday before last. And she said, you know, I'm really into every article in this issue. I love 1971, but I really love Jose de Leon's piece about rice as well. So I'm glad to hear that. That was actually one of the first pieces by someone on our team who actually does fact-checking and research for us, Joey, but he brought it home with that piece. So that's really nice.
That's fantastic. And finally, Dawn, what can we expect from Bon Appetit in 2021? Because, I mean, we were mentioning the COVID era, whatever, but this year, I don't know, there's a sense of optimism, especially there where you are in the United States. People are being vaccinated and who knows, things are opening again.
Yeah, so we're optimistic that, and we also want to support our restaurants. So, you know, we're at this funny intersection where we want people to cook, but we also want them to treat themselves to the expertise of chefs who just put so much time and thought into, you know, bringing us delicious and beautiful meals. So you'll see our restaurant issues in October where we can throw some light on what a revised restaurant community looks like. I'm really excited about our May issue, which is going to be on sustainability. And then in June, if I can give a little preview, we are leaning into that. You've been cooking for over a year, so get out and enjoy the sunshine. Get out and enjoy the weather. And here's some what we're calling short and sweet recipes. So we're challenging ourselves to keep our standards up, but also providing our readers with recipes that they can do that won't take all day so that they can be outside. I know we've missed it. I've missed it.
That was Dawn Davis there, and Bon Appetit's April issue is out now. And now it's time to move on to the world of crosswords. I personally am a big fan, although not very good at it. From the serious broadsheets to tabloids to weekly magazines, they are everywhere. And for a reason, readers love them. So that's why I decided to speak with one of my favorite crossword makers, Matt Gaffney, who writes them for New York Magazine, among other publications. But before that, I have here in studio with me our very own Tom Edwards, who is here to talk about his love of crosswords, and more specifically, the cryptic ones. Hi, Tom.
I like cryptic crosswords. I thought you were going to say, because we're going to talk about it, we had to get a big nerd in. Because that, I mean, they have a bit of a reputation. But actually, crosswords offer so many insights. And what I find really interesting is the sort of cultural learnings you can get from looking at crosswords in different markets. But they just offer so much. I think they're thought-provoking. They're clinically proven, Fernando, to be very good at aiding mental faculty, particularly in older people. So you can literally stay healthy and sane longer by doing crosswords. And I think because of the last 12 months, obviously people have been stuck at home. It's like puzzling generally has had something of a renaissance. So even certain magazines, obviously we're speaking on the Stack, the New Yorker, it now runs a crossword in print, which it did for a short time before, but it's now back with some real relish. So yeah, I think crosswords, you scratch the surface and it untaps this whole other world. That's one of the things I find really interesting about it.
And it must be such a tough job for someone making a crossword, because if they do anything wrong, people will complain. I mean, I think generally people buy newspapers or magazines sometimes just because of the puzzles or their favorite crossword, right?
Fernando, when I used to work at newspapers, woe betide you if you made any mistakes with anything to do with the crossword, or if you moved it from one section to another. I did make some pretty big mistakes when I worked at a newspaper, but you never got anything like the invective if you monkeyed around with the crossword. The crossword aficionados are very, very particular about the detail. And so, yeah, I think maybe once ran like yesterday's crossword again. Oh, it was bad. There's a full-on uprising. But the setters are real cult heroes, Faye. It's a tough job, sure, and you've got to be pretty smart and you've got to have a certain kind of aptitude and faculty, but the most beloved crossword setters are revered. I've read a couple of books about people who became obsessed with particular setters and then sought to find out more, or sought to even go and meet their heroes. So it's an amazing sort of fraternity. As I said, it's another aspect, this sort of social aspect, the sharing aspect of it, that makes it compelling.
I mean, Matt Gaffney is an excellent one, but give us another tip. What are your favourite ones, Tom?
Well, actually, the only one that I routinely do is the crossword in Private Eye, which I think I've said on this programme before, is one of the few titles to which I'm a regular subscriber. And it's a little bit, as you might imagine from a satirical magazine, it's wry, Fernando, it's a little bit rude on occasions. But Cyclops is a setter, and I really like Cyclops's puzzles. And it's funny, you get into a kind of shorthand. You get to understand. It's almost like the accent that somebody has, the accent almost of the setter's setting. So that's the one that I do. But I mean, my nerdy fandom of crosswords has led me even to read a couple of books. Sandy Balfour wrote an amazing book called Pretty Girl in Crimson Rose, which is a crossword clue. Quite a tricky one. Maybe we'll come back to that later. And Alan Connor wrote a great book called Two Girls, One on Each Knee, which is another crossword clue. Bit easier, I think. And so these are books where you go inside the kind of mind of crossword fans. And it's a real, to my way of thinking, treasure trove of delights that you find when you gaze inside.
Thanks, Tom. That's very interesting insights. Let's hear now my chat with Matt Gaffney.
Well, I was a kid in the 80s, and my sister started bringing home these puzzle magazines. She was interested more in the logic puzzles. She left the crosswords alone. But I was drawn to the crosswords. I began solving them. And then for whatever reason, and then maybe I have a competitive nature, I decided I could write these maybe as well as these people. So I started writing them and then sending them in, and I was off to the races.
And how does it work? I mean, do you send and then the editors, they check and see if you're a good one? Does it take time? Or do you think this, the biggest crossword makers, they're like, how can I say, they're a league on their own? It's quite hard to crack into this market.
Well, back when I started was the pre-internet era. So it was much different. It was much slower, like everything else. You packed up your, you know, you physically packed up a copy of the crossword and mailed it off to an editor. And then maybe months later, you would hear back from them. I still have in my possession a 1.5-page letter written to me by a guy named Wayne Robert Williams, who is the editor of this one puzzle magazine called Dell Champion Crosswords that I used to enjoy and send to. And that's where I had my first puzzles published. And he sent me back, he didn't accept my first puzzle, but he sent me back this 1.5-page critique of what I had done wrong. And it was like receiving a gold brick in the mail. It was just, I couldn't believe this guy had taken this time to write me back. Now, of course, you have Facebook groups where you can get instant feedback from dozens and dozens of skilled constructors, and you can hone your craft much more quickly that way. But back then, getting just that little bit of critique was so valuable and so unusual because it was difficult logistically.
And for which publications are you currently doing crosswords? I know your work very well for New York Magazine, which I subscribe, and I really like the way you do it. But how is kind of your work? Is it just for New York Magazine or for other publications as well?
Well, I have a few publications that I write regularly for. One, as you said, is New York. I also do current events puzzles for the Daily Beast every 5 days a week. They're just mini puzzles. And then I do a sort of somewhat similar puzzle for The Week magazine, but it's only once a week and it's a larger puzzle, so it gets a different treatment. And then I also write contest crosswords, which is sort of a variant of crosswords that I'm best known for, perhaps. And these are a little bit more complex, and I've written one every other Friday for the Wall Street Journal for the past 6 years or so. And before that, the way they found out about me and started running this puzzle is I have had my own crossword contest on a weekly basis for the past, since 2008, so coming up on 13 years.
And do you have your own style of crossword? Because, you know, I do, you know, for example, here in the UK, there are quite a lot of newspapers that have crosswords daily. But for example, yours, I find that there are quite a lot of, there's a strong connection with pop culture, you know, so it's very current. It's not just who did this painting in the 16th century. And I quite like that about you as well. I think that's, is that your style that you would define?
Yeah, it depends on the market. You might aim for a more, for example, with my Daily Beast puzzle, I aim for things, they're written about 48 hours before they're actually published. So there's no lead time at all, basically. So you want to keep as many things that are in the news as possible. With my other puzzles, I aim for more of a mix of contemporary and classical knowledge. That's sort of my ideal. If I was left alone and said, you can do whatever you want, I prefer that mix of having to know, you know, a character in Twelfth Night crossing with a rapper who just hit number 4 with this song that everybody's playing on the radio.
You know, I love that as well. I love that mix of questions. And for example, I have one of your crosswords in front of me. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you for all the answers. but there's one, if you don't mind, I'm quite curious. For example, 9 across. And don't worry if you don't remember, but 9 across, Mars or Mercury, example, with 3 letters. I don't know that one because I thought it was Bruno, but I'm wrong probably.
It's a bit of a misdirect. It's not a great misdirect because I want people to think it's planet, of course. And you look at it, it's only 3 squares. So you say, well, it's not planet. The answer is God there. because Mars and Mercury are both Greek, or let's see, Mars is Roman and Mercury is also Roman, I think. So it would be a better misdirect if God and planet both had the same number of letters in it, and then you would put in planet and get it wrong and find out the answer later. But that's the idea behind that one. Moderately clever.
How funny. My mind was completely another place. I was thinking Bruno Mars, Freddie Mercury.
Oh, you know, that's a misdirect I didn't even intend, but that's a very nice idea too. Yeah, those are both the surnames of very famous pop singers. So didn't even notice that.
And Matt, another thing I was going to ask, I mean, there must be quite a lot of pressure on your job as well, because I think I heard from someone that if someone's going to send a letter to a newspaper, it's because the person who did the crossword did something wrong, you know, because clearly it's something that, as I said, people buy a newspaper, a magazine, sometimes just because of the crossword. I mean, do you get those letters, or perhaps just saying thank you that you didn't, there was no mistakes at all?
Yeah, you do get a lot of people just saying thanks, I enjoy it, and I always appreciate those, and I always write back. It is true, I forget what this various market research has found over the years, but it's some really shocking percentage of people that will buy a certain newspaper just for that little sliver of real estate, that crossword puzzle. You know, that's their number one reason, almost in many cases the exclusive reason for buying the newspaper. So newspapers know that, which is why every single newspaper pretty much of any size has a crossword. But yeah, I get mostly positive letters. If I do have an error in a puzzle, I certainly hear about that. And there is a certain triumph attitude that letter writers have when they catch me in an error. I understand it. I think I've fooled them so many times that for them to be able to say, aha, got you back, they like that.
Matt, I got to be honest, even though I do love crosswords, including yours, sometimes I do find it hard. Do you have any tip for someone perhaps who's not like the biggest expert on crosswords, or... I mean, I guess you just have to be knowledgeable, right? But
yeah, one big tip, which kind of surprises people, is when you're first getting started, don't be afraid to cheat a little bit. If you're solving online, this is really easy to do, because sometimes you get stuck at a crossword and you can't make any progress, and people just throw it aside and say, I can't do this. But often just getting one word or even one letter can break open the entire rest of the grid for someone. So if you're solving online, software now has a cheat function where you can pick a certain letter you want, a certain word you want. You can check and see if there's any wrong letters. So I would advise people to not be stubborn or proud about cheating a little bit here and there, because it's a good confidence booster, because you can say later, oh, if I'd only gotten that one word, I would have had the whole puzzle, because I did after I got that word. And you realize they're not as hard as they seem. And if you can get past these breaking points, you can really get the whole thing more often than not.
And Matt, finally, I was going to ask, I mean, do you know many people in the crossword community or other people like you that do puzzles and crosswords for magazines and newspapers? Is this a community that share tips and kind of advice? I'm very curious about that.
Yeah, there is. In the US, I would estimate its core size as maybe 1,000 people. And that's not all people who write crosswords. It's people who write crosswords, it's probably more like 300-400 maybe. But included in that 1,000 would be hardcore solvers. In the pre-internet era, we mostly got together. You know, it was difficult. You got together, you could send letters and stuff, and you saw each other's work in magazines and newspapers. But we would get together at conventions each year. The most famous one is called the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament. And that's been held since 1977 by Will Shortz. He's the director of it and always has been. He's the crossword editor, of course, of the New York Times. And so we would see each other there. But now with Zoom and Facebook and everything else, you can really get to know people, you know, pretty well just by Zoom and by emails and texts. There's a guy named Jeff Chen, who's a pretty well-known crossword writer who's come onto the scene in the past 8 or 10 years. And he and I have corresponded so much and just, you know, written about each other's work and stuff. And finally, about 2 weeks ago, I said, he lives in Seattle and I live on the East Coast. So I don't know when we would meet, you know, we would have to show up at the same tournament somewhere. So I said, let's have a beer over Zoom. And we did. This was about 3 weeks ago. And we had a great time. We had so much to talk about. We had to cut it off after 2 hours just because we were getting tired. But just a million things to discuss in person. So it's much easier now, of course, and we do have a community, and it's supportive and fun, and we are all drawn together by our love of crossword puzzles. So that's cool.
Amazing. Well, and besides, you know, buying New York Magazine, where else can our listeners find out more about your work, perhaps even your contest as well?
Yeah, I mentioned the publications I write for. I have a weekly crossword contest that I've been doing, I mentioned, since 2008, and that's a bit of a different breed, but I give people a gentle introduction to it. It's a subscription service. You can just Google Patreon and my name, and it'll pop up. It's called Matt Gaffney's Weekly Crossword Contest. And it goes out every Friday afternoon, New York time. And solvers have 4 days. They have until Tuesday at noon to submit their answer to it. And it's kind of a different type of crossword that's really taken off in the past, really the past 5 years or so, where it's not just like a regular crossword where you fill in the last letter and you're done. With this one, there's some extra answer you're looking for at the end. That's the final contest answer to the puzzle. It could be like a state capital or a famous actor or a river. It could be anything. And somehow, via some unique mechanism, it's hidden in the grid or the clues. And they can be very simple, or they can be so difficult that it kind of ruins people's weekends in a good way. That's a lot of fun. So if people want to Google that, they can. And I'll see them there if so.
That was Matt Gaffney there. And Matt, thank you so much. Lovely chat. And hopefully I'll be able to complete your next puzzle on New York Magazine. And finally on the show, a new title in the newsstand, and it's all about good news. What a delight. It's called Paperboy by David McKendrick. Featuring all the good things in life, it's a much-needed dosage of optimism in the world of print. I had a chat with David about the idea behind Paperboy.
Firstly, thank you for having me on the Stack. Very excited to be here. I guess a starting point for that should be, as you mentioned, a paths have crossed before at Esquire, which would indicate I've made a lot of magazines over the years, and I was the creative director there when I think you were just starting out. And I think Paperboy was born out of a few reasons. Maybe first and foremost, I've been making magazines for other people for 20 years, and I'd always wanted to exercise the right to make my own magazine. And I guess 12 months ago, I'd been robbed of my social life and any ability to get outside kind of ignited that spark, if you like, to get it up and running. And I guess also I teach a little bit at universities, and a few tutors from the universities I'd been in touch with were really struggling. You know, they were really feeling for the students who were graduating without a degree show. And I kind of way I felt a necessity to combine these things. And obviously over the last 20 years I've had an array of contacts, array of photographers, artists and writers. So I kind of, my idea was to generally blend these big gun contributors with younger people who were graduating, who I guess were suffering a lot. You know, even going back to my old high school, I managed to get some kids to write from the English department and some other kids to illustrate from the art department. And yeah, I guess the main crux of it, as you'll have seen, Fernando, is when you open it says it's good news only. And that was the last reason really to do it, is every time I turned on Radio 4, I was bombarded with bad news. Every time I, you know, looked at my apps, it was bad news. So I guess I felt it was a natural course to try and bring some good news. In a fairly blunt way. and the idea, that's where Paperboy came from, really. So, you know, the idea that there's this Paperboy who's manifested itself and only delivering good news.
And I think it's so, I love how playful it is as well. So even in your introduction, there's a little kind of some stamps as well. I mean, in case you've enjoyed Paperboy, you know, to send to someone you love and someone they might enjoy. So I think that's kind of part of the playfulness. To be honest, I'm not really sure if I'm going to send it to someone because I really like it. I might have to collect it. But I love how playful it is.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it was influenced with the times. You know, I started to send letters to people. I hadn't sent a letter to someone in 15 years. And I think the last one was to pay a fine. So I think for me as well, and you probably feel from the tactile materials, I wanted the magazine to live a little bit more of a life, you know, so it's bound with a cloth that's fundamentally for books, which should be kept. And yeah, I think the idea with the playfulness of putting stamps in there to send it on to someone you like, I think was a natural cause, if you like. I had found solace in sending letters or sending books to people that I like. So I don't know, I guess that was part of the idea, that we could communicate in a slower pace, and I was enjoying that. So I think that fed into that as well. But yeah, I'm glad you find it playful. It was the intention.
And of course, I mean, because of your big experience in the world of magazines in the past as well, I think you also have kind of a lot of contacts and amazing writers you've met, because I mean, if you look at the list of people that contributed with amazing pieces for the magazine, you know, a lot of respectable names as well, I must add.
Being honest, I drew a wish list up, and it was ambitious to say the least. But in the old-fashioned manner, you know, I got on the phone to people and explained, I guess, what I've just explained to you, and everybody seemed fairly up for it. And I think what was nice about it is people were happy to be mixed with undergraduates and high school pupils. And that was kind of the mix, you know, the big writers and get them illustrated by someone who was 15. So I enjoyed that real mix of high and low. And I think in that spirit, I think people were encouraged. And the guys that I've worked with for, you know, 20 years and I've met, I mean, apart from the bribery of red wine and dinner after lockdown, I think, you know, I think they felt that the spirit was there. I also gave people a fairly loose brief, which was to write, draw, make pictures about good news. And that's where my brief ended. And I think everybody kind of delivered on their own personal take on that. Apart from Jeremy Langmead, who we both know, who decided it'd be better to write about how he preferred bad news rather than good, which is fairly typical.
And I love the bits about the, you know, the small pleasures of life. That one about souvenir caps is so cool, because I love souvenir caps. And to be honest, during lockdown, they're very needed, actually. I mean, my hair is getting a little bit out of control. And I mean, what's your small pleasures of life, David?
I'm glad you picked up on it, because one of the small pleasures that I found over the last 12 months was shopping in my own wardrobe, which was, I've been robbed of a guilty pleasure of mine, that having a bad day, I would find myself in Soho or thereabouts in clothes shops buying clothes that I didn't necessarily need. That, you know, again, I was robbed of that, and I found a great pleasure and actually quite a satisfying feeling in shopping in my own wardrobe. You know, I discovered items that I never had, and I guess that's what spurred on the souvenir caps. You know, I was looking back into my archive. I was digging out old tie-dyed socks and thinking, yeah, I must wear them again. So my simple pleasure again was, I guess, looking at what I already had and trying to be a little bit more humble about it rather than consume. So that was one of my pleasures. But yeah, that led into the fashion pages that are within Paperboy. And I think, you know, again, there's a few stories in there where we address new clothes, but we also say, you know, Paperboy, you can shop in your own wardrobe. And there's used and secondhand items amongst the high-end new items, so seasonal items. So it was a particularly, I guess it was anti the advertising model as well of magazines. You know, a lot of magazines these days rely solely on, you know, advertising revenue. And I think for me, I was quite conscious of not pursuing that business model, if you like. And it gave me a freedom with the fashion pages to really experiment and suggest that people, you know, bought at all levels of, you know, from high end to secondhand clothes.
And David, you know, you mentioned their business model. I mean, with your agency as well, I wonder, do you feel optimistic about this year? Let's focus perhaps more on magazines. I mean, of course, you literally have a new magazine out, which is, that's incredibly optimistic and very nice. But what about with some of your other clients or other people in the industry that you've been talking? Anything for us to be even happier, perhaps?
Well, I guess I focused a lot of my good news on Paperboy. Aside from that, as you mentioned, you know, I'm a founding partner of a design and art direction agency called BAM. And we were born out of publishing and magazines. And we have felt a change. You know, we've been around for 7 years and we've felt a change. We've felt a real drift from print moving into a more digital communication just for very obvious reasons. And that essentially, whether good or bad, has accelerated over the last 12 months. We have a big client who closed the magazine that we've been working on. We did 6 issues of Christie's magazine every year. And they've decided at the beginning of the lockdown that they were going to close the magazine. So that wasn't great business. But at the same time, we've had a surge of clients trying to communicate digitally. Now, I could say that that is almost, you know, a lot of print disappearing, but they're wanting to communicate in an editorial manner digitally. And I think they're finding that it's not as simple as they thought it would be. And you know, they require experts and there's a degree of hierarchy in the people that they employ to do it and the journalists that they employ to write for their online literature, if you like. But at the same time, optimistically, I've started reading books and magazines much more than I used to. Again, probably because I've been robbed of a social life, but these are one of the many things that I'm hoping to hang on to. And I think people will, you know. I mean, Paperboy came out 2 weeks ago and there's been a huge surge and a huge demand for it. And it was a demand that I never expected. And I guess I'm just super encouraged by that.
That was David McKendrick from Paperboy. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monocle.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify and SoundCloud. And before we go, a little song for you. And the song is from 1971, indeed, the year that changed food forever. This is Carole King with I Feel the Earth Move. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me. I feel the earth.